Welcome to The Honest Report, a weekly podcast analyzing media coverage of the Arab Israeli conflict, anti-Semitism, and radical Islamic terrorism.
Violence escalating between Israel and the Palestinians, hundreds of rockets fired from Gaza toward Israel, people running for cover.
We start the show with the breaking news that has been coming in. Israeli police are saying that at least seven people have been injured in a car ramming and stabbing attack in Tel Aviv.
Hundreds of rockets fired from Gaza towards Israel. People running for cover on this Tel Aviv beach as air defense systems blew rockets out the sky.
Here's your host, Rob Walker.
What exactly is the explanation for anti-Semitism? No matter what excuse is cited by those seeking to demonize Jews, it fails to explain the pervasiveness and intensity of Jew hatred, both from the extreme right and the extreme left. But despite the inherent illogic in anti-Semitism, there remains a tendency and attempt to explain and categorize it. Our guest this week is attempting to put all that to rest. Alex Rifkin is co-executive officer of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry and an author whose recent book, The Seven Deadly Myths, Anti-Semitism from the Time of Christ to Kanye West, seeks to guide readers through the specific myths underlining anti-Semitism and, in turn, help offer Jews, their allies, the news media, and the public at large the tools to understand and combat. Welcome to the Honest Report podcast. Alex Rifkin, welcome to the Honest Report podcast.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
The honor is all ours. Your recent book, you've recently produced your latest book, The Seven Deadly Myths, Anti-Semitism from the Time of Christ to Kanye West. You tell us, anti-Semitism has been called the world's oldest hatred. It's ubiquitous. It's one of these things where there's anti-Semitism even in places where there are no Jews anymore. At the same time, it's also a hatred that has its own name, and that's been really thoroughly discussed and researched. What did you hope to bring to the discussion with this book?
Well, I hope to bring my own analysis to the great question of why, the why of anti-Semitism. Why is it that for thousands of years the Jews have been so hated, so brutalized? Why is it that even today Jews are shot in their synagogues and beaten in the streets and their tombstones are smashed? Why does this phenomenon occur? And it's something that's, I think, puzzled thinkers and particularly Jewish writers for a long, long time. And this was my contribution to that body of work. And in conducting that line of inquiry, you know, I came up with my own theories and perhaps favored some things that were written prior to me more than others. I sympathize very much with the Jean-Paul Sartre view about the conception of this mythical Jew, which bears no resemblance to the actual flesh and blood Jew, and that this was something conceived by the West to lay all the ills of modernity upon some living, breathing thing. And the novelist Philip Roth took a kind of similar view that the Jew has this doppelganger, which is the object of all this hatred and contempt. But through the process of, you know, answering this question of why, it kind of occurred to me that the why is not so relevant. It's fascinating, but in terms of actually addressing anti-Semitism today in the here and now, I think it's far more important to understand how anti-Semitism works, how it's transmitted, how it's passed on, how it infects societies. The why is there and it will always be there, but the how is something which we can actually work with. And Isaac Herzog, in giving an endorsement for my book, he said that by shifting the emphasis from the why to the how, we can actually confront and diffuse this hatred. So this is what I was really trying to do, to look at the method of transmission of anti-Semitism. And what I discovered was that it all comes down to a series of conspiracy theories of myths that have been honed over centuries. And every anti-Semitic attack, whether it be the shooting at a Chabad in San Diego in 2019, the horrific massacre in Pittsburgh synagogue, various random crimes, they're always attributable to one of these myths or some fusion of them. So I thought that by analyzing these myths, showing their stupidity and their malice, where they come from, they'll be less potent, less effective, and people will become less manipulated by them. And so anti-Semitism can finally be confronted.
Now, as you just mentioned, you're more interested in really less evaluating sort of the historicity of how, would, you know, why this uniqueness and really in terms of how to address it. But I wonder, to play devil's advocate, one might say, well, Alex, in order to fully address or combat something, we really have to understand sort of its genesis. How would you respond to that?
Look, I don't fundamentally disagree with that. And at the beginning of the book, particularly in the introduction, I give a kind of 4,000 year history of anti-Semitism, and I give theories as to why it is the Jews were hated. And my view is that it began with very practical, rational reasons, that the Jews were a minuscule nation in a time of great empires, and they refused to assimilate to those great empires that conquered them, to the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Greeks, and the Romans. They refused to pray to their gods, and they stubbornly stuck to their ways. And this was a time when lesser peoples were simply washed away or absorbed by these great empires. And few are hated so much as those that forget their lowly place. And I think that's what led to that initial animosity towards the Jews. Then obviously the Jews were the first nation, the first people to conceive of a single, all-powerful, ever-present divinity and reject the worship of idols and many gods. And as we know, that concept of ethical monotheism then began to spread, and Christianity and Islam came from it. And those faiths realized very quickly that they couldn't thrive if they were viewed as mere sects or derivatives of Judaism. And they had to achieve this hard split, either coerce the Jews to accept their new faiths, which they weren't prepared to do, despite the best efforts of Islam and Christianity to persuade them. But failing that, they had to then keep them in this permanently degraded, isolated, humiliated state as living evidence of their defeat. So these really are the origins of anti-Semitism. But what happens over the centuries is that people move away from those initial rational reasons, perhaps, and it just becomes something ingrained and available and inherent. And so this is the point at which the why becomes less important, and the how becomes, in my view, critical.
So I want to quote from your book here, and not to beat a dead horse, I do want to ask you a little more on the why before we move to the how, but you wrote here, quote, "The Jewish enigma has aroused some measure of benign curiosity, even some reverence." You're speaking historically, of course. You continue, "but overwhelmingly the Jews aroused fear and suspicion. In the pages that follow, we'll find men for whom anti-Semitism became a creed and evangelizing mission. These individuals could manipulate those fears and suspicions and recruit others to the cause of bringing the Jews low, seeing them humiliated and destroyed," end quote. So what is it about, one can understand this sense of how the Jews were used as a scapegoat. The other, right, they were different, they spoke a different language, these had these strange customs. One sees it only also in Jewish liturgy, in the book of Esther, right? That's how Haman, right, the villain of the book of Esther, sells the attempted genocide to King Ahasuerus. But yeah. The Jews, of course, were not the only strange people in many parts of Europe and elsewhere. What was it about the Jewish behaviors or traits that made them such an attractive target for hate?
Well, I don't think there's one particular trait. I think it's a combination of characteristics, and the points that I mentioned earlier about being, having that stubbornness, that stiff-neckedness, and refusing to assimilate and give themselves over to what were viewed as being more powerful civilizations and empires certainly aroused hatred. Maintaining that their conception of God, their prophets, their testament were complete and sufficient. Again, in a time when conquered tribes simply took on the faiths of their conquerors. But the Jews didn't do that. And then, for example, when Muhammad appealed to the elders of the tribes that lived around him to accept his new faith, their response was a classically Jewish response. And that was to, as the historian Ibn Ishaq writes, to annoy him with questions and challenge his propositions as to why this new faith is a legitimate successor. And they found him very unconvincing. So all of this really aroused this kind of contempt for the Jew, this tiny little people. Who do they think they are, maintaining their ways? And even the fact that the Jews don't proselytize, which we would view as a virtue. We don't push our faith onto others. But that kind of created this greater view of this Jewish hubris, this arrogance. They're so confident in their views and the correctness of their perception of God that they don't even have to convert others in order to bolster their case and their credibility. So I think there's a lot of those factors. And then there's practical factors. When the Jews begin their exile, they spend 2,000 years living in the lands of others as an easily identifiable, numerically minuscule nation within a nation in some cases. And in times of irrationalism, in times of pandemic and economic downturn and civil war and revolution, all forces that frequently overcame you know, Europe and the Islamic lands, the Jews were just there. They were there and fit to be plundered and murdered for the great release of hatred and all of these things. So it's a combination of the practical and I think the ideological. But all of these things, I think, really made the Jews unique. I think few nations, no nations really, had the history and the evolution and the role of the Jews. And we see that today even with the state of Israel. I mean, no nation lost their land, lived in exile, maintained their peoplehood, and formed a national movement to return to their ancient lands. It's something unprecedented in human history and something without successor. And all of this, as I said in the quote that you gave, in some cases, it arouses curiosity and interest. The Jews have never been anonymous. They've always been spoken about. But man, being fallible and weak and insecure and malicious, often uses the Jew as an object of hatred, much more so than admiration.
So reading your book, you are, in many situations, quite graphic discussing the kinds of abuse and genocide that the Jews experienced in recent centuries, and it really is difficult to read. How important was it for you to, when people think anti-Semitism today, they know the Holocaust happened, but to really spell out the depth of hatred, as you spell it in your book, that there's not just efficiency that explains the hatred that we saw in the Holocaust. There was almost a circus-like atmosphere. How important is it, do you think, for people to understand that this wasn't just automatons doing an action because they were afraid of repercussions or the banality of evil, as Hannah Arendt called it, but that there was this atmosphere? Why is it important that you disturb people, I guess, in such a way that they read this?
Look, I think you're absolutely correct in your observation. And I mean, I don't come at it with the intention to shock and, you know, disturb people, but I think it's really, really important to do. I think it's important to lay it out exactly what happened. And as you point out, how it happened as well, I think it's highly relevant. And there's a couple of reasons for that. And the first is that, you know, statistics about the Holocaust, about 6 million Jews, and we can talk about numbers that died in the Cossack uprising led by Bohdan Khmelnytsky, of the hundreds of thousands that were killed there, and all these things, that they don't capture it. They don't fully capture it. People become desensitized to these numbers. You know, massacres and brutality and genocides have occurred throughout human history. But the kind of genuine bloodlust, the enthusiasm with which the Jews were routinely rounded up and murdered, burnt alive, flayed of their skin. And again, I'm going into graphic detail again here. But it shows something about how the Jews were perceived. And really got to the point where people were killing the Jews thinking that they were effectively lousing vermin in a field. And the Holocaust is the perfect example of that. You know, they're transported in cattle cars to purpose-built factories of death and gassed with a common pesticide. And to me, that was, you know, a perfect crescendo of how the Jews had been characterized over thousands of years, how they had been successfully branded as, you know, vermin. And it was important to understand that, how low all this propaganda and all these myths had brought the Jews, to the extent that these things, these atrocities could be carried out, inflicted upon them so regularly by so many people in so many places. So in order to make that point, I think one has to go into that detail. And it also, I think, calls into question basic humanity. You know, when you read the accounts of, you know, as I mentioned, of Bohdan Khmelnytsky and his Cossack horsemen, what they inflicted on Jewish communities, you really have to question humanity. And when we're here in the realm of politics and sociology and history, I think we really need to, in order to understand what we're dealing with here, we need to be very frank and clear about what occurred, what transpired.
Now, there's a human action, I suppose, when faced with this kind of hatred. There's fight or flight. And so how do you, sort of taking this compendium of millennia of hatred, of anti-Semitism, some of it genteel and some of it brutal and shocking. And how does one take that and turn that into proactive action and not simply let it overwhelm them with shock and disgust and just a sense that humanity is unforgivable?
Well, I think you've again characterized it very well. And throughout Jewish history, we see those kind of dual responses. You know, we either fight and we become invigorated and we become more connected to our Jewishness, more determined. We live with a sense of purpose and mission, not only for our own sake, but as the custodians of a faith and of a people that have suffered so greatly, so few of whom have survived to this day. That gives us a great sense of purpose. And others simply turn away, I think, through apathy. And to me, it's an enormous tragedy. You know, when you look at what we've endured, what we've survived, and what a miracle it is and a blessing to be a Jew alive today, and to then give it up with a kind of shrug of the shoulders, to me is a really terrible thing. It's a really upsetting thing. But, you know, few Jews, or, you know, many Jews don't wish to carry that baggage. Sometimes it's easier to set down than kind of carry it on and pass it on to the next generation. So I think that we've seen throughout Jewish history and to this very day, some Jews becoming fortified in their sense of self and living through great purpose and wanting to give back to their people, and others just simply turning away. And I think that the more that we can teach the story of our people, the miracle of our survival, the depth and scale of our accomplishments, the more Jews will feel that they are a part of something greater than themselves and want to carry forward on that path.
Now, I don't want to spill the beans, of course, for listeners in terms of the seven myths that you talk about, but in terms of one of the mechanisms, of course, is the role that social media plays today in terms of online and Twitter, or X, formerly known as Twitter, is always being criticized for its, you know, lackadaisical, I suppose, approach to this. But to what degree are you concerned, or do you recognize that the role that, for example, social media plays today, or does it have a unique role, or is it, for example, part and parcel of just a larger, you know, millennia-long history, and this is just one of many fronts?
I'd say it's a bit of both. You know, throughout history, those who have been determined to attack the Jews, who have viewed anti-Semitism as a personal quest, they've used whatever means were at their disposal in order to advance that, to persuade people to spread these myths. And just to take a few people, you know, you have Henry Ford, for example, who used his enormous wealth and creative genius. He purchases a minuscule local newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, hires the best editors and muckrakers from Detroit, and then proceeds to run 91 consecutive editions of that paper, carrying vicious attacks on the Jews. And that then influenced Adolf Hitler and Nazi policy and so forth. In Moldova, in Kishinev in 1903, you had a chap by the name of Pavel Krushevat, also a dogged anti-Semite, who publishes The Rabbi's Speech, an anti-Semitic forgery, and spreads it there to spark the Kishinev pogrom, a key moment in the history of the Jewish people and in the Zionist movement. He then publishes the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. So having individuals who were overcome by anti-Semitism and determined to spread it by whatever means necessary is something that's always been around and always been there. But where I'm deeply, particularly concerned by social media, as we all know, is its enormous reach and breadth and speed. You know, and I talk about Kanye West in the book, and the fact that he was able to go on this kind of podcast and social media tour, this campaign lasting weeks, and spread every myth imaginable about the Jews, from Jewish money and power, filth and pornography, enslavement of blacks, and reach instantly millions and millions of people, young people all around the world, is something chilling and something we need to be deeply concerned about.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for sharing your time and some of giving us a bit of a picture, you know, some of the research that you put into this book, The Seven Deadly Myths, Anti-Semitism from the Time of Christ to Kanye West. Thank you so much again for your time.
Great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's today's edition of the Honest Report podcast. If you haven't done so yet, please subscribe to our mailing list, our podcast channel, and follow us on social media for the most up-to-date news. If you like what you've heard, please consider a donation to support our continued efforts at www.honestreporting.ca/donate. Until next time, thank you so much for listening.